This edition of Culture with Robert Bound was first broadcast on the 3rd of March 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to the 125th edition of Culture with me, Robert Bound. Sounds like a big number, doesn't it? Haven't we been busy? None more busy than on this show. Let us cut to the chase then. We'll track down the almost mythical Nigerian musical pioneer William Onyeabo, a man who made amazing music, then just stopped. A new film explores his influence on the likes of David Byrne and Damon Albarn.
William Onyeabo is a businessman. He's a musician, he's a filmmaker, preacher nowadays, and he is still, I think, a total mystery.
We stay musical with what seems like a bit of a chat down the pub with J.P. Bean, who's earned Jarvis Cocker's first commission as editor-at-large of publishers Faber & Faber. Singing from the Floor traces the history of British folk clubs.
Industrial ballads, some traditional Scottish ballads, children's songs from Glasgow and Manchester, prison songs, including some contemporary ones, soldier songs, sailor songs. That's the kind of thing they were doing.
And we speak to the photographer Bob Adelman, whose photographs of the American civil rights movement, and in particular the speech of Dr. Martin Luther King in 1963, for once really deserved the adjective iconic.
I've wondered for 50 years why I took the definitive picture. I was not a member of the press, but I knew everybody. So people let me in, and I was maybe 5 or 10 feet from where Doc was speaking.
Plus, Toronto's finest Basha Bulat joins us for this week's Midori House session. We get dressed up for a night out at the revived 1930s Diamond Horseshoe Supper Club in New York and enjoy the highlights from this year's Montreal en Lumière. That's all here on Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. We'll first introduce you to our musical guest, Canadian Basha Bulat, furnishing us this week with three tracks of what you might call chamber pop. Piano and guitar, irresistible melody, vocals right up close to the microphone. I think I'm right in saying I reviewed Basha's debut album in the first ever issue of Monocle back in 2007, so it was a joy to welcome her into the studio to perform tracks from her new LP, Tall, Tall Shadow. Here she is first with Wires.
Talk me out of my lies and forgive myself for trying. Tell me to be brave tonight. And if we compare the timing, take me out of the wild. Build up my frame of mind and burn it till you're set on fire. Tell me when you cut the wire. Talk me out of this time. Open this heart of mine. Tell me, did you cut the wires now? Open this heart of mine. Hope for my sake, you know, study well before you hear it. Every beat and every note you'll remember when you're near it. Take me out of the wild, build up my frame of mind and burn it till you're set on fire. Tell me when you cut the wires. Talk me out of this time. Open this heart of mine. Tell me, did you cut the wires now? Open this heart of mine. Take me out of the wild. Build up my frame of and burn it till you're set on fire. Tell me when you cut the wires. Talk me out of this time. Anything to remind me. Help me if we never find it. Open this heart of mine.
That was Basha Bulat performing Wires for us here at Midori House. We'll have more from that stunning session throughout the show. First, though, to another time. In 1970s Nigeria, an unknown man started making strange synthesizer-led funky Afrobeat like no one had ever heard before. His name was William Onyabor, and between 1978 and 1985, he self-released 8 albums recorded in his own state-of-the-art studio, where he even pressed and shrink-wrapped his own records. But just as he reached the top of his fame, producing tracks which are still adored by the likes of Damon Albarn and Caribou, he stopped making music. He became a man surrounded by mystery. Where he was, what he did next, or who he even was in the first place, no one was really sure. Late last year, David Byrne's Luaka Bop label re-released some of this work, much to the delight of critics the world over. They managed to track down Onyabor in rural Nigeria, where they found a born-again Christian living in a palatial home who wasn't and still isn't interested in speaking about his past. A short film chronicling this journey has just come out, and cult producer Katie Bulbauer, entranced by his music and the mystery surrounding him, just had to find out more.
Really fantastic introduction. It's a hella funky track, and it's kind of him at his best. But if you hear one, you're going to want to hear all the others.
It's pretty hard to believe that this is Nigerian music from the early 1980s. Recorded, produced, pressed, and packaged by one William Onyabor, British TV and radio host Lauren Laverne is not the only fan. Damon Albarn, Caribou, and Martin Ware of the Human League are just a few of those from the music industry who have sung the praises of this mysterious Nigerian musician. So who exactly is he?
William Onyabor is a businessman. He's a musician, he's a filmmaker, preacher nowadays. And he is still, I think, total mystery to myself.
He's kind of like everything that you imagine and maybe more. Eric had been to his house before and had shown me kind of like pictures on a BlackBerry of the house. But until you see it, it's kind of a magical place.
That's director Jake Sumner, and before him, Eric Wells, label manager for Luaka Bop. They've just released a film called Fantastic Man, which tries to explain who William Onyabor is. Luaka Bop re-released some of his music last year. But despite going over to visit him several times, Eric says there are still basic questions which remain unanswered.
I haven't been able to figure out really like how he was able to do this, but also how he had the interest and the will to do this. He always feels more of a businessman than an artist. So if you have this money to invest, where do you get the idea that you're going to invest it into electronic music? I think that's so fascinating. Musicians and studio engineers that we've met that worked with him, no one really understood him. No one really understood why he wanted to do the music that he made. And he never performed live. He didn't make his music to perform live, which is so different to how everyone else makes their music in Nigeria. You have like a 10-12 band. It's really about the live performance. It's not really about the recording.
Eric's been over to Nigeria several times in the last year. But he says that getting him to talk about his music is nearly impossible.
When I'm there, I spend a lot of time with him. He calls me in the morning and asks when I'm coming. He wants me to get there as soon as possible. And then you spend all day there till like 6 or 7, just watching Christian television. And if you're lucky, you get like a couple minutes out of this day when you can get close to like music, something music related. And however you get into that, you gotta like sidetrack in some way.
Many facts which are known about William Onyabor. He released 8 albums between 1978 and 1985, less than a decade after the country's bloody civil war. He lives in Enugu, southeastern Nigeria. But aside from that, the rest is basically a myth. Google him and you'll read that he studied film production in Russia, that he was a lawyer, that after making music, he went on to run a flour mill. But most of these stories have never been verified. So the first time Eric made contact with Onyabor by phone, he had a few questions for him.
The first time we tried to ask him, anything related to his past, he was quiet for 30 seconds. And it's the most heavy, awkward silence I've ever experienced. I was so nervous, I thought he was going to hang up and never speak to us again. And I'm standing outside our office and I'm like sweating. And then he says, "Is this an interview? I don't want to go back to that. I only want to speak about Jesus Christ." I mean, that's also, I think, a very Nigerian thing, that people just look ahead. They don't really look back. No one is preserving anything. No one is archiving anything. It's just about the next thing. So anytime I'm there, no one understands why I care about this old musician. No one cares why I'm trying to find records.
Onyabo refused to be interviewed for Jake's film. Instead, Jake tells the story through interviews with musicians, DJs, historians and ex-colleagues, cut together with archive footage and the story of their journey to Nigeria.
I knew him when he was doing wheel films. And you know he's a giant. He feeds once a day. And when he's eating once a day, he will eat up the food that about three or five people will not consume.
But between him and Eric, they've spent quite a lot of time with him. And Eric speaks to Onyabo on the phone a couple of times a week. So what is he actually like?
He took a liking to us. He's kind, he's a sweet guy, and he's got weirdly like a really good sense of humour. Like, he makes kind of funny jokes about himself the whole time as being this kind of like higher being, which is pretty funny.
But as Eric explains, he's much more complex than initially meets the eye.
I've heard, you know, many stories about how he can kind of turn, how he can be very sweet, but then how he can become very harsh. There was this one moment during my second trip when the taxi driver that I'd used for that day to get to his house was ripping me off. He got so furious and he starts like scolding him for like 10 minutes. It's not negotiating, it's just like telling someone off, you know? And he was so furious that he was doing this to me. And then I understood, you know, what he can do if it's not, you know, done in his way.
Eric also says that although Onyabo ostensibly shuns publicity, he's also keeping tabs on most of his media coverage. It would seem he might be more in control of his brand than we might think.
Anything he does, he knows exactly what he's doing. He's incredibly sharp. He's so on top of everything. He turned 70 this year, and he has a bunch of computers. He Googles a bunch of stuff. It's so contradictory because you come to this town and it's so isolated. It's so focused on religion. Everyone's carrying a Bible. Everyone's carrying a religious pamphlet. All day long, he's just watching Christian television. It just doesn't like add up, you know?
At the film's premiere in London, I ask Lauren Laverne why we should be excited about it.
A lot of people will already have the Who Is William Onyabo compilation, or they might have one of the original records, but nobody knows anything about this guy. So even at home, at the time that he was releasing his records, you know, he was regarded as a very kind of mysterious character at home in Nigeria. So he really is an enigmatic person and you know, almost impossible to track down, and fair play to these guys for having done that.
Judging by their reaction, it's a sentiment that the audience here tonight clearly share. Perhaps William Onyabo's mystery is the secret to his success. And perhaps he's more aware of this than we might think. For Monocle, in London, I'm Katie Bilboa.
And if you want to watch The Fantastic Man film, which is directed by Jake Sumner, it's available online the world over. Just visit noisy.vice.com or search for it on YouTube. For those just joining us, you're tuned into Culture with me, Robert Bound, where it's time now to don our check shirt and our holy jumper, set the beard trimmer to bushy, and sup a pint of mild. Folk music in the UK is a fascinating story, from the John Barleycorn end of things, songs about ploughing the fields and scattering, to a decidedly urban lyrical conscience, songs about industrial labour and industrial decline. Folk is a sort of musical version of an oral tradition. Songs abound in storytelling and social conscience. From the backrooms of pubs to large venues and artists being signed by major labels, the music gelled the ideas of the anti-nuclear argument and class struggle, for example, into the public's consciousness. The musical biographer J.P. Bean spent 4 years interviewing the characters that put the music on the map. Among the stars are Ralph McTell, Ewan McColl, Martin Carthy and Billy Connolly before he started exclusively telling jokes. J.P. Bean came into the studio to talk us through his wonderful book, Singing from the Floor, A History of British Folk Clubs.
Here's another from 1958. Ballads and Blues presents Princess Louise, Wednesday the 29th of January, 8 p.m. Ewan McColl, one of the most outstanding of our folk singers, will cover a very wide range of his special programme of British material. Industrial ballads, some traditional Scottish ballads, children's songs from Glasgow and Manchester, prison songs, including some contemporary ones, soldier songs, sailor songs. He will teach you some of these and in his own style will introduce you to his vast sources of information. That's the kind of thing they were doing. That's John Foreman, once known as the Broadsheet King. Lives in Camden Town still. Spoke to him last week.
Across the evening sky, all the birds are leaving.
The first folk club as such was in Manchester, started by Harry and Leslie Boardman in 1954. That was known as a sing-around. But quite soon, they then started calling them folk clubs. You'd pay to go in, £2 or whatever, 10p as it is now, and so it went, and they'd book a guest singer. Sing-arounds were just for themselves. When they started to expand, and that's when the professional singers started to come into being, I guess. And a circuit started to develop.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of folk songs relating to industrial scenarios, mm-hmm. industrial hardship songs. It's not just about, I think people think of folk music, they think songs of the countryside.
It's a rural thing, don't they?
Yeah, they think of some kind of shepherd. I think Cecil Sharp probably engendered that idea with the sort of people who he took songs from and cultivated more strongly. He didn't go into the factories, as far as I'm aware. It's always been around.
When did these songs that were performed in places that you frequented, when did they start getting laid down on vinyl, become albums, become works of the mainstream?
There were early records, small circulation. I can't remember what date offhand, it's probably in the book. But if you brought out 99 and no more records, you didn't have to pay purchase tax.
Right.
If you brought out 100, you had to start paying a lot. So the early Topic records, Ramblin' Jack Elliott, they just brought out 99 copies. And McColl, Topic recorded some with McColl, some with Bert Lloyd. The first folk singer to be taken up by a major label was Nigel Denver in 1964. Again, Nigel's in the book, I interviewed him. The year after that, Martin Carthy in 65 had his first album out on Fontana. And from then on, just grew gradually. Then Transatlantic came along. Topic were making quite a lot more than anybody else. Bill Leader was the main man at Topic. He worked on a shoestring and was responsible for the earliest records of a lot of people who subsequently became well known. Bert Jansch, Billy Connolly with the Humble Bums. Bill Leader then went to Transatlantic. Nat Joseph ran Transatlantic and he set up that label and went more towards the contemporary than the traditional. And then I guess the bubble burst. But you knew she was the one at the heels, and your suntan was rapidly peeling, and your wise men don't know how it feels to be thick as a brick.
I want to take you to where we are now in British folk. You said we're sort of having Revival 2, the revenge of folk music. Your book was commissioned by Jarvis Cocker at Faber & Faber, who's their new editor-at-large. The foreword is by Richard Hawley, also from Sheffield, who's a rock and roller, isn't he? These two people clearly have an interest in this stuff. Is there a red thread that neatly links all of you together and
this
contemporary music rather than Sheffield?
Sheffield. Richard and I have been friends for years. I'd written the book, I wrote it on spec, and said to him one afternoon in the pub, "Ooh, I've nearly finished the book. I'm going to have to start talking to publishers. This is the bit I hate," because I used to be represented by an agent and that had fallen away. And he said, "Jarvis, So I said, Jarvis. He said, Jarvis has got this job at Faber and Faber. There were a few expletives involved in this, which I won't go into. So Richard sent it to Jarvis, and Jarvis passed it on, and the rest is a fairy tale come true.
The rest is a history of British folk clubs.
There's a history of British folk clubs indeed, yeah. There have been some great moments along the way.
Well, J.P. Bean, whose new book, Singing from the Floor, is out this week, published by Faber and Faber. You're tuned into Culture with me, Robert Bounds. We're back with a big night out after this.
Monocle has shops around the world selling our exclusive collaborations with some of our favourite designers, including Ettinger, Porter, Barenna, Jawbone, Oliver Peoples, and many more. You can find us on College Street in Toronto, Hudson and Charles in New York, and in the heart of Wan Chai in Hong Kong, and two in London. So, whether you're after a versatile travelling wardrobe, something for the home, or a present for a loved one, or just missing back issues from your collection, you're sure to find something at the Monocle Shop.
Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bounds. In the late 30s, the Diamond Horseshoe Supper Club was one of New York's most famous nightlife venues. Made legendary by the Broadway producer and lyricist Billy Rose, it was a nod to the gay 90s with lavish parties, vaudeville troupes and showgirls. The club, nestled in the basement of the Paramount Hotel near Times Square, closed in 1951. But on New Year's Eve, it reopened for the first time with a new immersive theatre show, Queen of the Night. The show has been getting itself a fair bit of attention, so we sent Pauline Eiferman in a feather boa down there to see for herself.
Walking down the stairs to the Diamond Horseshoe is like walking back in time. Little by little, hints of the club's past splendor transpire through the decrepit staircase. Open the heavy doors whose handles are extended lifelike hands, and a world of glamour and sensuality is revealed. The room swarms with beautiful people having drinks at a bar that looks like the laboratory of a mad scientist. At the center of the space, a large stage is entirely covered with a Tom Brown gown that reflects madly in the light. In it is our Queen of the Night. This is no ordinary show. Before I can even take my seat, a young man in a structured black and white costume and piercing blue eyes takes my hands and asks me if I trust him. He pulls me out of the room through elevators and odd corridors and into what he calls the Siren Room. It's a narrow space carpeted with white fur and where strings of beaded white shells hang from the ceiling. He shows me out a few minutes later, just in time for the ceremony to start, he says.
We wanted to do a piece that was epic, because it's an epic space. So I think every aspect of this, we tried to go big.
That's Randy Weiner, the producer of Queen of the Night. He helped bring the British interactive play Sleep No More to New York in 2011, and is one of the creative minds behind the cabaret nightclub The Box.
We wanted to base it on an operatic theme because there's nothing bigger than opera. So we based it very loosely, as it turns out, on Magic Flute. The fantasy of opera is it's pulling together all the arts, the finest costumes, the finest music, the finest singers, the finest drama, finest sets. We wanted to do that. And then on top of it, we wanted to add food, and we wanted to add private areas, private spaces, build out these tiny rooms that were like little jewel boxes.
Immersive theater like this, though still rare and pricey, has become a very popular affair in New York. But it requires a lot of talent, time, and money to be done right. Above all, it needs the right space. And though the room I'm standing in tonight is flawlessly lavish, the Diamond Horseshoe wasn't an obvious choice just a few months ago. It was in the late 30s that the club had its heyday. Buried deep in the basement of the Paramount Hotel on West 46th Street, the theater was made legendary by Billy Rose, who transported audiences with old vaudeville troupers and glamorous showgirls. Jesse Harris is a filmmaker who just completed a documentary called Underneath the Paramount Hotel.
Billy Rose was possibly one of the most famous, most powerful impresarios and producers in the United States, certainly, at that time. He started out in show business being a songwriter, and he actually had about 12 hits, a couple that are actually really well known. Me and My Shadow, Frank Sinatra did a cover of it, and many other people as well. What he did was bring back nostalgic entertainment. He brought back vaudeville, because by 1938, vaudeville was pretty much passé. However, he knew that people wanted nostalgia. The nightclub became very popular with tourists. In fact, it was so popular, it was listed in tourist guides right alongside Statue of Liberty, the Empire State Building, Billy Rose's Diamond Horseshoe. And the design of it was so important to him, and that was part of the way he brought people back in time. His desire was to sort of transport people away from, you know, well, the Depression was waning, but we were getting into the Second World War, and people wanted to escape their problems. And he had 12 amazing years in that space. And then, of course, nightclubs died.
The club closed in 1951 and stayed dormant for more than half a century. Only a select few, like Randy Weiner, were lucky enough to enter.
We had been brought to the space probably 6 years ago to look at it, because for 60 years, I think people have always thought there's this incredible hidden jewel underground in Times Square. Someone's got to figure out how to use this. We fell in love with it. We were like, oh my God, this is the ultimate, to be in Times Square and this place with so much history.
Two years ago, Randy got a call from A.B. Rosen, the real estate developer who had just purchased the Paramount Hotel. He was meeting with everyone, nightclub operators, restaurants, Broadway shows and DJs, to find the perfect show for the Diamond Horseshoe. After just one meeting, the two decided to work together. The resulting show, says filmmaker Jesse Harris, would have made Billy Rose proud.
What the new producers have done in terms of this immersive quality is, it just blew me away, because it's so similar to what Billy Rose was doing. You know, it was kind of the moment you walked in the door, you were in this other universe, this other experience, this other reality.
But despite the show's number of impressive contributors, which include the set designer turned director Christine Jones, the creative director Giovanna Battaglia, the designer Tom Brown, and the food artist Jennifer Rubel, the performance wouldn't be complete without the guests of this glamorous party, the audience.
Sometimes you do a show and you see it about five times and you're like, you know, I got this show. But this is so complicated, this show, because every night the audience is part of the experience, because it's truly immersive. When people dress to impress the queen, as, like, you know, people call it, they are really helping to tell the story of the excessive affair this queen's putting on.
As the evening comes to a close, dessert is served. I'm dragged to the dance floor, where I'm spoon-fed chocolate cake. I find my neighbor, who had mysteriously disappeared. And suddenly, it becomes unclear who's acting and who isn't. The queen has retired to her chambers, but the guests will very much keep her party alive. For Monocle, in New York, I'm Pauline Eiferman.
Thanks, Pauline. And if you're interested in seeing Queen of the Night, it's on at the Diamond Horseshoe Club at the Paramount Hotel in New York City until the 6th of April. Still to come in part two, more Basha Bulat and her rather soulful Midori House session. We go to Miami to meet the man behind the lens of one of the most iconic civil rights era photographs and soak up the sounds of one of Canada's biggest cultural festivals in Montreal. An Oscar-winning selection, you might just say. All right, time for another track from our Midori House session, this week provided by the Canadian singer-songwriter Basha Bulat. First, we'll hear her performing It Can't Be You, and then a chat. What makes Basha tick?
and where do those beautiful songs come from?
I was practicing what I had left to say, but I can't say now. No, I never thought that you would have the nerve to go and shoot her down. You were terrified of love, and then you finally let it out. But I knew. Coming, but I never thought it would be so soon. If it's fire for the poor with the feathers and Tommy with the glue, I never dreamed that you would be the one to shoot me down so soon. Oh no, 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 it can't be you. It can't be you. It can't be you. Can't be you. It can't be you.
My first two records I recorded entirely on tape, didn't use any computers, we did it completely live off the floor, very little editing. I mean, you can edit tape, but yeah, it's a little more difficult. Whereas this record, we kind of mixed analog and digital. So we did some to tape, some digital, and you know, some of the instruments were acoustic, some were electric. And I think people are kind of enjoying that. I think it seemed, I mean, for me, I needed that change. I definitely knew I was going to lose some of the hardcore folkies along the way.
Yeah.
Maybe for going electric or what have you, but I figured.
You got a bit, someone's shouted Judas at you.
No one's done that yet, but, you know, there's always a first. I'm looking forward to that moment. But I also think, you know, I wrote this record after one of my closest friends, we grew up together. She passed away very suddenly, very young. And I kind of wanted to make a record that was the sort of thing that was honest about how I was feeling and could also be uplifting in some way and would be the kind of thing. I wanted to make something that would kind of honor her and be something that I thought that she would like to listen to. That's always the risk when you write something more personal, is that are you going to alienate people if you're too specific about your own experience? But I think, at least I hope, I kind of walked the line between putting myself out on the line, yeah, so to speak, and letting people kind of find their own way to connect to it. And so it's been really moving for me to have, you know, people who have, you know, found something in their own life or found some way that they saw themselves in my songs. It's been really kind of emotional, I guess.
Tell us about some of the gear we've had in Studio One here. So half of it's still sort of festooned in the corner, which is nice. I like the way this looks. I think a room decorated with musical instruments is a pretty good room. But there's all sorts of stuff. I guess this is the stuff that you recorded it on as well. We've had two different types of harps. We've got a tiny little guitar, the name of which I can't remember.
It's called a tarango. It's a 10-string. Okay. It's kind of a relative. It's a kind of a cross between a lute and a guitar. Uh-huh. A lot of people mistake it for a ukulele, but it's got It's got a little more...
It's got a few more strings, got a bit more going on.
Yeah, I mean, not to besmirch the ukulele at all, because I love the ukulele and I play the ukulele. But yeah, the charango I fell in love with. It's a beautiful instrument. It's got its roots in the Andes and it's very popular in Bolivia and Peru. So It Can't Be You is what I played on charango.
Uh-huh.
And then I brought a hammered harp. I call it a hammered harp. There's sort of this period of time at the turn of the century, of the last century, where there were a million and one kind of parlor instruments being made without patents, and everybody was kind of using the same name. So some people call it a pianoette, some people call it a marxophone. And
a pianoette, I
yeah,
like that.
And
it's sort of the moonshine ripoff versions of real musical instruments.
That's sort of what it is, yeah. And then I've got your kind of regular run-of-the-mill auto harp, an electric one.
And the world's smallest piano.
Yeah, basically the Casio SK1, it's kind of one of the first samplers, and it got really popular, and there's a whole bunch of little keyboards that are like it, but I particularly love the SK1.
How does it work live? Do you switch around between everything live, or do you have to? Does it take quite a bit of tuning up to get everything? Because it seems like a very soulful record. They seem maybe as a non-musician, I say, well, that seems quite simple. It's, you know, but I guess to give those songs that texture and to give it that resonance, you want to jump between instruments when you play live, when you're playing tonight and elsewhere, right?
Yeah. Well, I think when I'm playing solo, I kind of bring along the whole kitchen sink along with me, just because I. Kind of keeps me from phoning it in. It keeps me from kind of doing the same thing over and over every night. And I think in terms of the kind of songs I write, yeah, like I've always been really influenced by soul music and kind of classic pop writing. So I think I'm always kind of trying to write within like a small space and try and like open up a world with as few lyrics, I guess, as possible. But at the same time, sonically, I'm kind of also coming from a really folk kind of bass tradition. So I kind of just need to bring it all along with me, if that makes any sense.
That was Basha Bulat, who's currently on tour across the US and the UK. BashaBulat.com will give you all the details. You're tuned in to Culture with me, Robert Bound. It must be Monocle 24. It would come to be the crowning speech of the American civil rights movement, Dr. Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech, Washington, D.C., 1963. Protesters gathered on the great swathe of the mall between the obelisk of the Washington Monument and the steps of the Lincoln Memorial. A phalanx of reporters and photographers was corralled on a platform about 50 feet from the podium, but one young white photographer without credentials, Bob Adelman, was determined to capture the moment and found himself just a few feet away. Adelman, a New Yorker, had already been documenting civil rights activities across the country, and his dramatic photographs, published in national magazines and on posters, had illuminated many of the harsh injustices of the period. But it was the image he took that day, August the 28th, 1963, in Washington, for which he truly made his name. A large exhibition of his civil rights era photography recently opened at the NSU Museum in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, and George Fishman interviewed Adelman, now 83 and still very active, in his Miami Beach home.
I am happy to join with you today in what will go down in history as the greatest demonstration for freedom in the history of our nation.
When I investigated a subject, or doing a story, or working on a book, I was always looking for a definitive photograph or a series of definitive photographs that summed up what I was looking at and investigating. And I guess my modest expectation was, once I did something, nobody had to do it again very soon. When I went to the March on Washington, I went as a volunteer and only had no assignment. Many people were apprehensive at the time about it because they thought all those, you know, black people coming into the center of Capitol would lead to a race riot or something. Because finally, we had worked for years. Race was now on the national agenda, and the march meant that. But in addition, the gathering was a protest, a demand on Congress, which was controlled by the Dixiecrats, to get the bill done.
So what happened in Congress
they got around the Dixiecrats, the Liberal Democrats and moderate Republicans passed the bill.
Well, let's come back to where you were telling us about that day on the Washington Mall.
So I was, on that day, I was looking for the spirit. So I was looking for my heroes and friends from the movement. And of course, I knew that Doc would, you know, he's the greatest orator I ever heard, was going to make an amazing speech. So as the ceremonies began, I tried to make sure I got to the front of the podium and, you know, near where he was.
And just how did you manage that?
I've wondered for 50 years why I took the definitive picture, and I think I figured it out. The press, I was not a member of the press. I had no credentials, but I knew everybody. So people let me in, and I think I ducked under some people and I got up the steps near the podium. I was maybe 5 or 10 feet from where Doc was speaking.
Were you the only photographer who got right up close?
The press, people with credentials, could not go on the steps. There was an elevated area where all the press was. Of course, you know, I was blown away as I heard the speech, because this was greater than any speech I had ever heard him deliver. And I was trying to get closer, but there were all these dignified people there, and I'm trying to muscle my way, and it was awkward. And I'm trying to look for that definitive image. You know, I knew that as his oratory rose and came to a conclusion, that he would become much more expansive. First, he's reading, but at some point, apparently Mahalia Jackson called out, "Tell him the dream," and he dropped the speech and started to speak extemporaneously. Imagine that, to speak extemporaneously and coherently and unforgettably.
"Because I have a dream. My four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream today."
And I was, you know, waiting for that definitive moment as he's saying, "Free at last, free at last." I've heard that speech 100 times and it's still very moving.
"We will be able to speed up that day when all of God's children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will be able to join hands and sing in the words of the old Negro spiritual, 'Free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, we are free at last.'"
That was Bob Adelman talking to reporter George Fishman there. And you can see Bob's photos in the exhibition The Movement, Bob Adelman and Civil Rights Era Photography, which is on at the NSU Museum in Fort Lauderdale until the 17th of May. You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24. Next, Montreal.
The Singapore Air Show is a magnet for the world's most important aerospace companies, all of them eager to sell to the high-flying Asia-Pacific market. Monocle got strapped in to gauge the state of the soaring industry.
The requirements for new military equipment here are vast and include not only combat and surveillance aircraft, but tankers and transports as well. Patrolling maritime borders was, however, one of the more dominant themes, and that's no surprise given current tensions in the region.
Pushington at the 2014 Singapore Air Show, premiering in the Films menu on monocle.com.
Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bounds. Well, Canada's brutal winter is drawing to a close, and for the shut-ins of Montreal, it's time to get out and party. For the last week, the city's been shaking off its layers of snow, projecting interactive light installations up on buildings, throwing massive outdoor gigs, and scoffing large amounts of Haitian food. It's Montréal en Lumière, Montreal in Lights, the first big event on this festival city's packed annual calendar, and one of the biggest cultural events in Canada. Montréal en Lumière also incorporates the city's white night, Le Nuit Blanche, which is 24 hours of art, music and slightly frosty debauchery. We convinced our Montreal correspondent, Patrick Pittman, to take a look.
We're in Montreal's Place des Arts, surrounded by the city's best galleries and museums. But that there is the sound of more people than I can count, lined up with their orange sleds for a run down a luge track. The city's been under a blanket of snow now for several months, but enough's enough. It's time to get out. This is Montréal en Lumière, Montreal in Lights. The buildings are covered with interactive light projections, and Place des Arts and Place des Festivals are strewn with food carts and pop-up bars, including one in a fetching geodesic dome. But there's more going on here than just the fairground. Quebec is an insular place, and its culture doesn't tend to travel too well, but it should. And there's no better sampler of what makes this an extraordinary place, from its cheeses to its beats, than this. I asked Emily Côté, music critic for the local daily newspaper La Presse, what makes this festival special.
It's a really nice event, and some people can go to the nice restaurants and try more like the gastronomic part of the festival. You have indoor shows at Place des Arts, which are more high scale, if I could say, and smaller shows and at Club Soda and everything, so it's a good mix.
I grabbed Laurent Saulnier, vice president of programming for the festival, and asked him to explain to me what was going on with this sprawling program.
This festival is fun to program because it's about everything. It's about jazz, it's about French music, but it's about rock, it's about classical music, it's about lecture, it's about dance, theater, etc., etc.
For an outsider, the festival's music program is also about peeking through windows. Beyond Quebec, when people think of Montreal music, it's probably names like the Arcade Fire and Grimes, or the city's post-rock mainstays like Godspeed You Black Emperor that spring to mind. But in reality, that's mostly confined to the city's Anglo pockets like Mile End. The French language papers repeatedly ask why most of the English speakers in Montreal, never mind Canada, can barely even name their city's biggest celebrities. Here, they call this separation the two solitudes. But the outdoor shows at Montréal en Lumière are a marvellous way into the thriving, if sometimes too proudly self-contained, Québécois music scene. On opening night, Louis-Jean Cormier played to 10,000 people. Emily Côté was blown away.
I've never seen that many people at the show. Well, we have to say that Louis-Jean Cormier is a judge at a really popular show, which is like The Voice, but in French. But he's from Carquois band, so it's come the indie world meeting the more mainstream world, so it was really, really interesting. It's really hard to describe how the French-Canadian music scene is really, really strong. There's a star system here, and it's easier for a French-Canadian band here than a band from Montreal, like unless you're Arcade Fire or Half Moon Run and everything. You can play on the radio, you can be invited in TV shows and stuff like that. The scene is really strong and is going really well right now.
The real highlight of the festival for most people is Nuit Blanche, the White Night. Like other cities around the world, on Nuit Blanche, the city throws open the doors of its galleries and venues for 24 hours, and you won't see the snow for the bodies. This is the first big party of the year. Emily tells me this has been a favourite part of the festival for years now.
It's crazy. But every year, I must say, you have to wait sometimes, like huge lineups. But there's really something going on that night in Montreal. Nobody cannot be like impressed about that. When they see that and when they are in the middle of it.
Kicking off Nuit Blanche is Ghislaine Poirier, Montreal's best-loved son of the dance floor. His parties in the city and around the world are the stuff of legend. For the last 5 years, he's been throwing a white night party, and I asked him what keeps him coming back.
The Nuit Blanche day, night, is just a crazy day. You would feel it's like summertime. There's like so much people downtown in other neighborhoods, walking, visiting, going to shows. And it's a crazy energy. I think like the first two years, I wasn't close to any events related to that. I was home. And then I got like a gig for Nuit Blanche. And I came downtown, I was like, oh, what I missed. And then I'm like addicted. I want to always be part of it.
For the creative culture of Montreal, winter is about survival, about staying inside and working on your novel or your album. But there's something intoxicating about the place. Solitudes, politics, and a polar vortex or two aside, Montreal is a city that knows how to party. For Monocle, in Montreal, I'm Patrick Pittman.
So that's just about all we have time for this week. Next time, we'll be enjoying a session from a very talented woman called Eska. Trust me, you're in for a treat there. And we'll also be exploring the world of the crossword and its enthusiasts. You've been tuned in to Culture with me, Robert Bound. My producer is Katie Bilbao, and Holly Fisher worked her usual magic to get all the things polished and looking good and bright and sparkling and beautiful. Time for one final track this week from her wonderful Midori House session. Here is Basha Bulat with 5-4. Thanks for tuning in.
Dark, eyes in the dark, looking forward, whoa-oh-oh. Yours, anything yours, anything ours, whoa-oh. Ooh, all I own. To cross, steady assault, whoa, young world in your heart, rivers I know, whoa, since I was alone here. Lake shore is glowing, all these things we've done before. Was it an accident? Was it an offering? Or was it yours? First five, now four. First five, now four. First five, then four. First five, now. So I don't want, can't be so.